Okay, so I'll describe. Thank you. I'll describe models.
Something's a pointer.
Oh, great. Models of the population of massive black holes in galaxies, and I think actually they could be described as something like very preliminary steps towards population synthesis models for LISA. However, I think these models are still extremely simple, so it's not possible, I think, at the moment to do really a population synthesis model for LISA. And instead, what I'll focus on in my talk is asking two very specific questions. But to answer these questions, I need to address essentially what will have to be addressed when you want to build these population synthesis models. So the two questions I'll address are the following. The first one is, how rare can supermassive black holes be at high redshift? We have heard this afternoon, and there is a lot of discussion in the literature about how common the supermassive black holes are in nearby luminous galaxies. That doesn't mean that they have to be very common in high redshift galaxies. So one question you can ask is, how rare could they be at high redshift? And I'll argue that they could be as rare as being present in only a few percent of galaxy at redshift 5. That's a very specific statement from the models that I'll show you. The second question is, is it possible to constrain the relation between the black hole mass and the stellar velocity dispersion in high redshift galaxies with LISA? And actually, unfortunately, you'll see, I think, by the end of my talk, that it's not possible to give a quantitative answer at the moment. But there is a suggestion that it will be possible to do that with LISA. So before actually trying to answer this question, I'll just spend a few minutes putting this subject into context and the motivation for doing this. So there's a number of things we know about the population of supermassive black holes. We heard a lot about dynamical studies. In terms of the model I'll describe, the thing I'll worry for now is just the result that we'll use in the models is that these black holes are almost ubiquitous. They're very common in nearby luminous galaxies. There is the galaxies that have been probed so far are luminous galaxies. So if you want to translate that in terms of a mass that has been like extensively probed, something like converting mass to light ratio or something. It's something like a total mass, and here I mean dark matter plus baryons, in excess of 10 to the 11 solar masses. And that's a number I'll use in some of the models I'll show you. We also know that the supermassive black holes are already in place at redshift 6.2 from the highest redshift quasar discovered by SDSS. We know a few things about the extent of the population from the quasar Lemniste function. The Lemniste function of quasar peaks at redshift 2.5 or something like this. And some people have tried to estimate actually what the fraction of bright galaxy at that redshift which contain a quasar. And that tells you a minimum fraction of black holes in galaxies at that redshift. That's something like one in 1,000. And I think recently actually X-ray studies have also given us some results about galaxies at redshift less than 3. The reason why I point out this redshift 3 or less than 3 is because actually it's going to turn out to be somewhat important in some of the models that are present. That there is a fair fraction of bulge-dominated optically luminous galaxies which show X-ray activity, which is presumably due, again, to the presence of a supermassive black hole. It turns out that for the models I will present today, the dynamical studies, that is the result that what we know of the population of supermassive black holes at redshift 0 is actually the most constraining observation for some of the models I'll present. So now, what's interesting with these black holes and the population is that we might expect naively them to merge as function of cosmic time. That is, in a popular CDM cosmology, the popular cosmology these days, your galaxy build up by successive mergers. So you would naively expect that the supermassive black holes in this galaxy will also merge as function of time and grow that way, just by successive coalescences. In fact, the coalescence of supermassive black hole binary is not an obvious outcome of the merger of the galaxies. And this was pointed out by Begin, Melbourne, from recent more than 2 decades ago. And the general scenario they outlined, which is, I think, still very much debated these days, is that, I mean, one of the ingredients is very much debated, is the following. So as the two galaxies merge, the black hole sinks via dynamical friction to the center of the galaxy remnant. And ultimately, they form a bound binary. And at late time, during this evolution, actually, the most efficient way for the binary to shrink in orbit and eventually merge is actually to kick out stars by slingshot effect, to kick out like stars that come very close to the binary, stars on low orbital angular momentum orbits in the galaxy, and to kick them out and give them some of the orbital energy, and that makes the binary shrink. And if that is efficient enough to make the binary shrink to typically subparsec scales in terms of orbital separation, then the loss of the emission of conventional waves will actually be efficient enough to make this binary merge very efficiently. The one thing I think we should keep in mind for the models I've presented here is that there is a very hot debate and it's still an open question as to whether this process of ejecting star is efficient enough. That is, the way it's stated in the literature is usually if you take two supermassive black hole binary, two supermassive black hole, a typical galaxy, then you find that it's not obvious you will be able to make this binary merge within a Hubble time. That's usually the way this problem is stated. Now, one of the main motivations to study these black hole mergers is, of course, LISA. And I'll just spend one page on this, and so I'll go very briefly. I'll describe very briefly LISA. There's a lot of interesting things, but I'll just go to the point. From the point of view of the model I'll present, what's interesting is that LISA will be able to, depending on the mass and redshift of the supermassive black hole, if they merge, LISA will be able to detect the Gaussian wave emission from the in-spiral phase, the actual merger, and the ring-down phase after the two black holes have merged and they relax to a quiescent Kerr black hole. So, in fact, what turns out to be the most interesting, at the moment, the most interesting phase is the in-spiral phase, because that's the one we understand the best. And there was a very illuminating paper by Scott Hughes recently about actually a more detailed discussion of what we can achieve with LISA, the precision that can be achieved with LISA. That is, LISA will be able to see these events. But in the Gaussian waves themselves, there's actually a lot of information on the dynamics of the binary. And in principle, you can measure the individual masses of the black holes and the distance to these black holes. And actually, Scott showed that for some appropriate combination of mass, you could do that with high precision. So let me try to go through this very briefly. All the mass combination, like the typical mass that people discuss in this context, is chirp mass. It's a like weird combination of the two individual masses of the black holes are redshifted in a cosmological context, and the amplitude of the signal is a function of the luminosity distance to the source. So in principle, you can get this redshifted mass combination and the luminosity distance to the source. And what you need to know to actually really get to the masses itself, to deredshift the masses, is actually to obtain from the distance a redshift. And you need to do that, you need to know cosmology. So what Scott did is a Monte Carlo simulation for equal mass binaries of various masses at various redshifts, and ask with what precision can we invert these relations and determine basically masses and redshifts for this equal mass binaries merger with LISA. And what he showed is that with a good precision, and good here means 30% or better, you can determine the masses and the redshift of mergers if the masses involved are within 10 to the 5 solar masses of 1 plus z. So it's one order of magnitude up or down of this, basically. And in some cases, the precision is even much better than this. So I think to astrophysicists, it's quite remarkable to think you can get the mass to 30% of two black holes merging at high redshift. It's really nice. And the other thing I want you to keep in mind is that actually, if you don't worry about where this merger happens, so you don't worry about getting a distance and trying to estimate the redshift, what you still get from the integrated counts from LISA is the redshifted chirp masses. And typically those are determined with really exquisite precisions. At least for these equal mass binaries, it can be much less than 1%. So there is a lot of information about the black holes that you could learn from LISA. So the question is actually, what do we expect in terms of a population synthesis model? So the tool that we can use to try to answer the two questions I introduced early on is a so-called merger tree, dark matter halo merger tree. So that's a tool that's used very often in cosmology these days. It's basically a tool that describes the merger history of dark matter halos in this case, lambda CDM cosmology. And what it tells you is that given a halo, or actually, so in this model, I'll assume a one-to-one correspondence between halos and galaxies, which is reasonable for low-mass halos. It might not be for high-mass halos. But so I won't make the difference between halos and galaxies from now on. So what this merger tree tells you is that if you take a galaxy at a given redshift, it tells you what it was made of in the past. It gives you the mass distribution of the progenitors of the galaxy. So with this tool, what you can do is start at a given redshift, in this case 5, and you get a distribution of galaxies that is prescribed, and you can follow how this galaxy merge and build up with redshift. And so if we can find some way of populating these galaxies with black holes, we can actually follow how black holes evolve, the population of black holes evolve in this galaxy with redshift. When two galaxies merge and each of them contain a black hole, that's what is here, actually you get potentially an event for LISA. We don't know how these supermassive black holes are formed. The thing you want to do is the simplest thing possible. If dark matter is not self-interacting, you would think that you can only form these supermassive black holes by baryons. So you need to be able to, for the gas in these galaxies to actually cool from stars eventually, and then somehow you'll form a supermassive black hole. In cosmology, there is a standard assumption, standard rule that is adopted, is that you need your dark matter halos to be massive enough for the gas that is present at the formation of these galaxies to be hotter than 10 to the 4 Kelvin. Otherwise, this gas is not able to cool within a Hubble time, and you actually cannot form stars, and presumably you cannot form black holes. So what we can do, this is one thing we'll assume in these models, that you need these halos to be massive enough to reach this limit at which baryons are able to cool and you can form black holes. And from there on, we don't have any rule to populate this halo except, or these galaxies, except that we can imagine that all the galaxies we have represented here actually do contain a black hole, or maybe a small fraction of them contain a black hole at high redshift. And actually, the specific question I'll be asking is, how rare can black holes be here at high redshift? And by the successive mergers, actually, the occupation fraction of these galaxies in the merger tree will increase with the cosmic time. So how rare can they be at high redshift, so that you have to agree with this Magorian et al. And all these dynamical studies at high redshift, that they are present in almost every single galaxies, luminous galaxies at redshift zero in the nearby universe. And so when you have rare supermassive black hole at high redshift, we have only two choices. These are very much idealized models, but you have only two choices. Either you there's a small fraction of black holes. Either you populate them randomly, you don't care about the mass of the galaxy, or you say maybe they are formed preferentially in most massive galaxies, so you populate only the most massive fraction of the galaxies you've chosen. And so what happened? So what I'm showing you here is a model with a fraction, occupation fraction of black holes at redshift 5, which is 3%. This is this number here, the lower panel. And you see that by the successive mergers, actually this occupation fraction increases with cosmic time. But actually, it increases even more as you look only at more and more massive halos. This is a halo mass here. This is because more massive halos actually have more progenitors, so they tend to be more easily populated with a black hole as a function of cosmic time. So if you remember the mass I mentioned early on, 10 to the 11 solar masses, which is a mass that has been probed extensively by dynamical studies so far, and I guess I'm referring to quiescent galaxies here. You need to reach a number of order unity here. And this is what we adopt as the most extreme model acceptable given the observations in the local universe. That is almost unity here. We can discuss that maybe later. If you go to even more massive halos or galaxies, this number would be even higher. So it's the boundary between having, you know, this being 80% or 100% is not quite clear. But this is certainly acceptable. If you go to 1%, if you populate only 1% of galaxies at redshift 5, then this number will be like something like 50% here, and that's probably not acceptable. So the conclusion you should, I guess is I had this the statement earlier in my talk that it seems possible that only a few percent of galaxies at redshift 5 could harbor black hole, and still you could agree with what we know for the population of black holes in the local universe. And it would predict that actually, if you were to look at smaller mass galaxies, they would be much less efficiently populated from this diagram. Now, one reason why it's interesting is because this will have a dramatic effect on the event rates for LISA. If you populate only a small fraction of galaxies at high redshifts, you get a number of mergers of black holes which is much less than if you populate all these galaxies at redshift 5. So what I'm showing you here is a prediction for LISA of the number of black hole merger events per year, per unit redshift as function of redshift. This is a solid line here. The thin lines are just standard deviations that you get from the merger tree. And this is for a model in which all the galaxies are are populated with black holes. And there are two extra assumptions that you have to make to get this curve, is that all this merger will be detected by LISA. There is no mass. We don't need to prescribe a mass for the black holes here. So we just assume that all these black holes will be massive enough, will be in the right mass range to be detected by LISA. And also that these black hole mergers are efficient. Remember, I told you that it's not obvious these mergers are actually efficient. And so if you assume that, you get this rate that is strongly increasing with redshift. The reason why we don't go beyond 5 is because we don't trust this merger tree beyond 5. But that could be extended in the future, I think. And you get like several hundreds, something like 500 events at redshift 4.5, within redshift 4 and 5 in this model. Now, if you go to this more extreme models, where actually you populate the smallest fraction of black holes you can imagine at redshift 5, you can see that the rate drops by almost two orders of magnitude. In fact, depending on whether you populate massive, preferentially massive halos, massive galaxies, or like you populate these galaxies randomly with mass, you get a different evolution of the rate with redshift. So presumably, actually, what this is, if you invert what I just showed you, if you invert the problem that's telling you, depending on the rate that LISA will see, and even the rate with redshift, you should be able to tell something about the extent of the population of black hole at high redshift. Right. So let me just mention one caveat again to come back to this time, the time you need to actually have two black hole merge. What I'm showing here is in the same model, so this model with 100% occupation fraction for the black hole at redshift 5. The distribution of time between successive black hole mergers. And you see actually that it peaks at like less than giga year. So actually the usual problem of how efficiently this black hole binary merge may not be even properly stated in saying they have to merge in a Hubble time here, but like certainly in the merger trees that you see here, they have to merge in a fraction of a Hubble time. Of course, at high redshift galaxies have different structures, probably they might be more compact, so maybe they merge more efficiently. But this is very much an open question at the moment. This was to show how different redshifts contribute to this distribution, but I'll skip that. Obviously, these models are very much idealized, and you would like to be able to put associate masses with the black holes, because LISA is sensitive only to a relatively narrow window of masses, as I told you before. So what I'm going to describe here is a very simplistic, but I think plausible mass model for black holes. I'll focus only on models in which all the galaxies at redshift 5 are populated for simplicity. And then obviously we don't know much about the population of black holes at high redshift. We know even less about their mass function or mass distribution. So the simplest thing you can do is try to use what you know at redshift 0 in the local universe and extrapolate it to high redshift and see if it's plausible. So what I'll be using here is simply this relation between the black hole mass and the stellar velocity dispersion. And there is a standard prescription that people use in lensing studies, for instance, for elliptical galaxies at least, where they relate the velocity dispersion of the stars to that of the dark matter. So effectively, actually, this relation is actually relating the black hole mass to actually the mass of the dark matter halo. That's quite relevant to what Laura Ferrazzi, I think, discussed. And certainly, this appears to be reasonable, at least for elliptical galaxies. And I think Laura suggested it might be even valid for some spiral galaxies. But it's not that obvious. So given a dark matter halo mass with this relation, you can have an idea of the black hole mass you expect if the galaxy and the dark matter halo follow this relation. So I'll be describing this Ferrazzi merit model and Gebhardt et al. Model. They are somewhat different. You'll see also that because of the masses involved in the merger tree for the dark matter halo, this involves a significant extrapolation at small masses. So that's another thing that has to enter here. I'll be making two other assumptions here. One is that when two black holes merge, there is negligible loss of mass to Gaussian wave radiation, which is not necessarily obvious. You could lose some fraction of the mass to Gaussian wave during the merger phase. And also, I'll completely neglect accretion. I'll assume these black holes only merge by successive this black hole grow only by successive mergers. And actually, I was very worried about this because in principle, this relation might not apply. Relating the black hole mass to the dark matter halo mass, yes, might not apply to certainly bulgeless galaxies or even spirals. And I was actually very happy to see that maybe in some spiral galaxies, actually, there is a relation between the black hole mass and the dark matter halo. So, I'm not defending this as the right model for black hole masses that we should use, but certainly it's a priori it's using all what we know about black holes and their masses, and it's the simplest thing we can do. And so we can ask what will LISA be able to tell us if we assume this. Let me just before showing you what LISA might be able to see. So from this merger tree that I showed you, we have to assume something at redshift 5 and then let black holes merge at the masses, let the galaxy merge and see what we get at redshift 0. It's an evolution code. So if I assume this relation between black hole mass and velocity dispersion at redshift 5 with if I assume exactly this distribution, it's not obvious that by putting it at redshift 5, I'll have it conserve at redshift 0, actually. So that's the first thing I wanted to check. So this is this Fairazier-Merritt relation. So what I at redshift 5, I have a distribution of dark matter halo masses, and that from that I get a velocity dispersion, and I populate them according to this relation I just showed you, and this is what you get in terms of. So this is just by construction; it fits basically. This each point here is one of the dark matter halos in the merger tree, and by construction it fits. The question is, as you let this halo merge and this black hole merge, do you still fit this relation? Actually, so you might say, well, this is not so good, but actually, I think it's not so bad. The reason I say that is because you can think of tilting a bit the relation, or maybe adjusting it a bit, and you will reach something that, at least by the eye, I didn't do like exact fit here, by the eye is more or less consistent with what we know at redshift 0. So this is, let me show you, for instance. I take the Gebhardt-Lebesgue relation, and actually, I don't follow it exactly, I shift it down a little bit. I put black hole masses a little bit smaller than what the relation would give. So we can play with, I mean, it's not, I think, don't think it's very interesting, but then you get something that, at least to my eyes, an okay fit to this relation at redshift 0. So what I'm saying here is that if you assume this relation is in place at redshift 5, it is apparently conserved in this halo merger trees simulation at redshift 0. So this is in this is a plausible, it's a consistency check in a sense. It's a plausible mass model for black holes in galaxies that I'll use here. So, and with these models in mind, you can ask what the distribution of masses for the black holes which actually merge as function of time in these models. And this is what is shown here. This is a this is a Fairazier-Merritt relation. The distribution of masses in black holes involved into mergers from redshift 5 to 4.5, and then I'm showing here from 0.5 to 0. This is interesting because if you remember the number I quoted, Lisa is mostly sensitive to black holes within one order or two orders of magnitude, maybe of 10 to the 5 solar masses over 1 plus z. So actually, at redshift 0, that would be 10 to the 5, I mean, from 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 6, or a bit beyond. And at redshift 5, this would be a few 10 times to the 4, and like one or two orders of magnitude around this. So actually, if this is a proper black hole mass model for black holes at high redshift, this is telling you LISA will see a fair fraction of all these black hole mergers. The thing is, it's even better with the Gebhardt-Lebesgue model. It's not that I'm arguing for any preference here. It's just I just want to show that actually there is a difference between the two, that you get a little bit, just by extrapolation of this relation to small dark matter halos, small galaxies, you get even a slightly more massive black holes in this model. And so the question you can ask actually is, well, let's assume this is the right model for the black hole masses in galaxies. Will LISA be able to tell the difference between these two models, these two relations? And so then I have to use what Scott calculated. In the sense, he estimated the precision with which we'll be able to estimate the redshift and the individual masses of black holes involved in two mergers. And he says you can do that with 30% precision. So you can see here that it looks like there is some hope you might be able to discriminate between like this model, and I guess it's not very clear necessarily, but one or the other model, because they do make significantly different predictions for the masses. What you can also do is plot the distribution of redshifted trap masses. This is this quantity that is measured with very high precision by LISA. And here, what I'm doing is directly comparing these two models. Again, I assume they are like maybe the right model for black hole masses. And I'm asking, oh, okay, what do I get for the redshifted trap masses and the contribution from redshift 5 to 4.5? You can see they differ significantly in the two models. And similarly, from a chief 0.5 to 0, you get many less mergers. But again, they differ significantly. The number that Scott quoted is, if I can remind you, is less than 1% error, actually much less than 1% error on these masses. So you would think actually you would very easily be able to discriminate between the two models. That's not quite true because the statistics will not be as good. This is the number in the merger tree. This is not the number seen by Lisa. So you need to actually reduce these numbers significantly. And this is where actually I cannot give you the final answer, because to know exactly how much you need to reduce these numbers, that is to know exactly what Lisa will see, you need to know the transmission function of Lisa. And Scott basically calculated this for equal mass binaries. But most of the mergers involved here actually are unequal mass binaries. And actually, so the transmission function is different for these binaries. So what I'm showing you here is the black hole merger mass ratio in one specific model. In two different redshift windows, and you see you get a lot of unequal black hole mass mergers with unequal mass, I mean with small mass ratio basically. This is what I'm showing here. So I cannot give you the final answer here, but certainly I think there is hope actually that we'll be able to test these models with Lisa. And certainly, you might not. So these are very simple mass models for the galaxies. But if they were to be extremely different from what I assumed here, you would have extreme predictions from Lisa. Maybe if the mass spectrum is very different from what I assumed here, you actually wouldn't see anything almost. Certainly, we'll be able to do astrophysics with Lisa from that point of view. Just going back to those two specific questions, I ask. I think in one case it's possible to answer at the moment. It's possible to answer the question, which is that black holes could be as rare as being present only in a few percent of galaxies at redshift 5, to be specific. I can only say that at the moment. It seems possible that Lisa could constrain actually this black hole mass velocity dispersion in cosmologically distant galaxies. And I'll conclude here, just going back to basically the title of my talk. A lot of what I describe actually involve various ingredients that will be required to actually build real population synthesis model for Lisa. There is a lot of uncertain ingredients in what I describe, like in terms of cosmology, these merger trees, in terms of galaxy formation, this like virial mass of 10 to the 4 Kelvin for baryon cooling is somewhat debated, for instance. The issue of do bulgeless galaxy and spiral galaxy do they follow this black hole mass versus dispersion relation? Do they even contain black holes? Galactic structure and dynamics, it's very important what the efficiency of merging for these black hole binaries. And I think it's still an open question. And even general relativity, if you lose a significant fraction of the black hole mass when you merge them, this will actually affect this black hole mass versus dispersion relation. So these are all ingredients, and it looks like a daunting task to actually build a reliable population synthesis model for Lisa. But on the other hand, I think it's almost required to interpret the data. Because, for instance, let me imagine that we find out that the Lisa rates are very small, just a few events per year. There are several effects that could contribute to this. Black holes could be rare at high redshift, or the mass spectrum could be such that actually you don't see many of them. Or maybe this black hole binary merger process of ejecting stars is actually quite inefficient, and that would contribute to decrease these rates. If we don't do this type of population synthesis model, we won't be able actually to tell apart this difference between the, I mean, why these rates might be so low. So I think ultimately it will be necessary to build such models. Thank you.
Very close together, and they have to kick out low mass stars basically in order to get closer together, but they can get hung up at some distance. In your simulations, you assume they merge What time scale do you assume that they merge? I mean, how do you?
Instantaneous merge.
Somewhere in there, is it?
Yeah, it's just assumed to be instantaneous.
But if you, instead of assuming that it merges instantaneously, you know that there is a hang-up there.
Mm-hmm.
If you assume
you could
that,
put
it,
that, in, yeah.
that it merges at the next merger with a galaxy, because then you have three black holes.
Yeah, yeah.
Three
so
black holes,
yeah,
one
no,
black hole
so
maybe kicked out, and then the other two get much closer.
I didn't emphasize this, but let me go again to this plot. So here I said that maybe the typical time scale, at least in these models, that you would want this black hole to, the typical time between two successive black hole mergers is a giga year. Certainly, if they merge not very efficiently, you're right that you'll get maybe a third black hole, and maybe a fourth black hole, etc. Actually, you could add them up. And they, actually, the lowest mass black hole is usually kicked out. So certainly, if it's not very efficient, you would reduce the LISA rate because you get less mergers, but you would get also a population of massive black holes flying around in the galaxy. Hmm? Yeah, single black hole, yeah. Maybe these are the intermediate mass black holes.
Is there a mass bias?
Probably, yeah. I don't know the answer, but probably yes. Yes.
So, luminous accretion has almost contributes almost as much mass to the black hole as
right.
Just so I guess the effect is to lower the count rate. Is that all it's going to be if you include luminous accretion?
Yes, I think that's right. Actually, it will reduce the black hole mass. But actually, it's not clear to me what exactly that means, because the Sultan argument you're referring
yes.
to, I guess. If I were to, let's imagine a scenario in which you create your massive black holes initially from, let's say, massive stars of 1,000 solar masses, and there you were to actually merge them all the way up to 10 to the 7 solar masses, say, and then you would accrete for sulpicial time and you would get a black hole of 2 10 to the 7 solar masses. Okay, that's a plausible scenario. If you use a Sultan argument, that would tell you, yeah, to within 15%, everything has been done by accretion. But still, you know, you might possibly grow the black hole to very large masses by just by mergers. So it's not clear to me what the Sultan argument means. I mean, it probes only the highest mass, I guess that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It only probes the high mass black hole. So it doesn't tell you how you grew from very small masses to high masses.
I understand what the arguments are, of course, but I never quite understood how that scenario would be consistent with the fact that we do have an MCD correlation. When you do kick out black holes, wouldn't you expect to have galaxies with an undermassive black hole? So wouldn't you expect,
sorry, would you expect to have what?
If you start kicking out the third black hole because the first two have been merged by the next merger, you wouldn't have a tight MCD correlation.
No, I don't think that's obvious. There can be a lot of feedback between star formation, you know, star formation when you, how you affect the dynamics of galaxies during mergers. You can build up black hole mass with accretion instead of actually.
Right, but you have to do that in a practically very coherent way.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
no, that I agree.
The black
yeah.
holes will merge.
But you cannot rule that.
And then you have to survive
with
something else.
I agree with
so
that, but you cannot
try that you will actually be able to, not the relation itself, but the tightness of the relation. Seems very contrived to be able to actually.
But the model I showed assumed that the relation exists at redshift 5. This is very contrived too. I mean, at least to me, it's very contrived.
Yeah, no,
you,
but I'm not arguing.
You just the form and the and then. I mean, it's not obvious to me how you get the relation.
I'm actually supporting your hypothesis that the black holes do merge, and you don't have anything
there. Out the lowest mass black hole, that wouldn't be the lowest mass increase there. You know how scattered that would be probably consistent with the
interval.
by Rose a long time ago that showed that a second merger is very efficient at repopulating the Moss crop. So the second, the main effect of the second merger may be to flush the two existing black holes to coalesce.
Well, certainly I assume it's very efficient in the model I showed you, but I think people are still debating, it's very unclear. So, I mean, yeah, there have been ways that have been proposed to do that efficiently. There is also the Brownian motion of this black hole binary in the potential well. So, yeah. I think at the moment it's fair to say it's unclear.